Catch the NBA playoffs on Sling TV, the most flexible live TV streaming service, putting consumers in control to watch games their way with flexible subscriptions. Want to catch one game or a full series on ESPN? Grab a 1, 3, or 7-day pass. If you want to catch as many games as possible, get a monthly subscription with our ABC, NBC, and ESPN combo package. Either way, Sling lets you watch the playoffs your way with no long-term contracts. Learn more at sling.com.
Now at McDonald's, a McDouble is only $2.50. So you can get your gym gains on or just get lunch for only $2.50. Get more value on the under $3 menu.
Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher for delivery. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Hi there, Dan and Andy here. Just a little announcement before we start this week's show. We have reached the point where next week Anna Tajinsky will return. This is very exciting. She's back!
Yeah, she's back, baby. And we've had an amazing run of guests. It's been so fun, but there's no one we love more than Anna. So it's very exciting that she's going to be back. So put it in your calendars. However, we've got a very exciting final guest episode to go out with before the return of Anna, and that is with a fellow QI elf.
Yes, you may remember Manu Onryo. She has been on Ask the Elf, our little bonus show. And Manu, as well as being one of the writers of QI, is on the podcast Lunchbox Envy, which of course is also made by QI Productions. Lunchbox Envy is a show all about food, food from around the world, food-related paraphernalia. It is the food show. It's Manu, it's Jack Chambers, another elf who you will have heard on Fish and Fish products in the past, and Rosie McKean, the pasta queen.
Oh, yes, yeah. And so, as Andy says, Lunchbox Envy, they each come to the table each episode with their lunchbox, and each episode takes on a theme, and they kind of blow your mind with all sorts of interesting takes on the history of that food and so on. So there's about 65 episodes out there now, everything from the episode called Asparagus through to Mangoes, through to food art.
What are these all about?
You have to listen to find out.
That's right. So if you enjoy Manu's appearance on Fish today, we're sure you will enjoy Lunchbox Envy. Check it out.
Check it out now. And one last thing before we leap into this week's episode is to say, hey, do you like listening to us four dorks talk every week and you want more?
Yeah.
Why not become a member of the Secret Private Members Club, the one where we put up bonus episodes, where we have video, where we have online quizzes. It's a magical place and it's called Club Fish.
That's right. Just go to patreon.com/clubfish today and check it out and join us.
Join us. Okay. But for now, enjoy Fish, enjoy Manu, and enjoy some seaweed. Okay. On with the show. As a little teaser there.
Really good. I feel teased.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, a weekly podcast coming to you from the QI offices in Holborn. My name is Dan Schreiber. I am sitting here with Andrew Hunter-Murray, James Harkin, and Manu Onryo. And once again, we have gathered around the microphones with our four favorite facts from the last 7 days. And in no particular order, here we go. Starting with fact number one, it's Manu.
Okay, today my fact is seaweed bubbles could stop you getting pregnant.
That is a relief.
Oh, I know.
I have been trying to avoid it, but you can't.
Is that where Andy talks to a woman about seaweed bubbles and they don't want to have sex with them anymore?
Yes. I mean, that would also work.
Yeah.
No, so actually, this is a semi-edible seaweed bubble, and I brought an example for you to sample if you would like to.
Yes,
today. Please.
I brought with me something called agar-agar jelly, which is what my Indonesian auntie used to make.
Ooh.
So it's a sweet coconutty dessert thing. This one has been put in the fridge, and it's made using a seaweed gelatin. So it's vegan, it's very squishy. No pressure to eat it, but I mean, I think it's delicious.
Okay, Dan, can you explain what it looks like before? I know Andy is desperate to get
it. Yeah. It looks like a giant bit of tofu on top of a jelly-like substance underneath.
Yeah.
Like a whiteboard marker, you know? It's got that kind of vibe about
like
it.
Like a whiteboard rubber?
A rubber, rather. Yeah.
It looks like food we were told food would be in the future in the 60s. Like, in the future, they'll only eat stuff like just this wobbling, colourless, weird gelatin. But it tastes like a roast dinner, incredibly. Yeah. It tastes like a full roast dinner.
I mean,
well, have some and tell us what it tastes like.
I should have brought my tongs.
It's enormously gelatinous.
It kind of just disappears in your mouth as soon as you bite. It sort of just slides down.
Is it like eating a jellyfish?
Sorry?
Is it like eating a jellyfish?
Yeah,
it's like a jellyfish that's been in a mold, which jelly, I suppose, has because it's a jellyfish.
Yeah.
James, you're not tempted.
I'm not a big fan of seaweed, I have to say.
Oh, okay.
I will eat stuff. If that was disgusting and it was like a dare, I would eat it. Because it's quite nice.
Yes, because you've done the Museum of Disgusting Foods.
Yeah, I would do that just for the show, but to enjoy it, I'm very bad with texture.
It is very wibbly wobbly.
I think it tastes fantastic.
I love it.
Are you saying if I go home now, me and my wife won't get pregnant because I've eaten that?
No. Basically, agarose, the sugar derived from agar-agar, which is what we've just eaten, is used to make these special beads that can trick sperm into binding with them to kind of protect the eggs. And this is all done in mice. And what they did is they covered these beads in a protein called zona pellucida glycoprotein 2, or ZP2 for short. And what this does is it tricks sperm into thinking that whatever it is the egg, because it's basically sending out signals being like, I'm an egg.
Beautiful.
And the sperm are attracted to it.
It's like having a Wetherspoons. And then next door to the Wetherspoons, you've got another Wetherspoons that's made entirely out of jelly.
Yeah.
But they kind of cover it in the smell of stale beer and desperation. So that people are tricked into thinking it's that. And then all the men sort of walk towards his Wetherspoons, but they get stuck to the outside.
That is exactly right.
Dan, in-house Wetherspoons ambassador, is looking furious at this.
It actually attracts a very good clientele.
Are you a Wetherspoons? I had no idea you're a Spoons fan.
$1.49 for a pint of Ruddles. He's not a fool. He's a drunk, but he's nobody's fool.
I love it.
He's a drunk and a loser, but he's no fool.
It's very cool.
Yeah,
so that's extraordinary. It's a decoy. It's a decoy item.
Exactly.
That's been body doubles.
And they use this agar jelly because basically it has the same consistency as an egg, so it tricks them into it.
Yeah, I think they use this kind of agarose jelly a lot in microbiology to kind of sift through substances and build structures because it's basically like a nice squishy building block.
Yeah,
and
love living on it.
Yeah,
in the same way that agar, which agarose is derived from, is really good for petri dishes.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
So, are we using this, or is this in test mode at the moment?
So, this was a group of cellular biologists from Maryland in 2016. I tried to find out whether it's actually in development because I think it's a fantastic non-hormonal contraceptive if it works.
Right.
But like any kind of medicine, these drugs take a long time to develop. And I couldn't find out if they're actually in production, which I think means they're probably not.
I'm going to stick with the good old-fashioned methods.
Oh, yeah?
Which?
Conversation. just talk about wallpaper long enough.
Oh, yeah, no.
Headaches.
But what is really cool is it works both ways. So not only would it create decoy eggs, because the strongest sperm stick to it the fastest, it can also be used to select really strong sperm for IVF. So it's like a great way to prevent and a great way to encourage pregnancy when it's wanted.
That would be outside of intercourse, right? That would be a petri dish situation.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you bring the claw in.
So the use of agar and agarose to be used in science, it comes from the meeting of a cock and a fanny.
Brilliant. I can't believe you found that,
absolutely true. So in 1881, Fanny Hess was a German technician, and she was working with Robert Koch, and she had seen people using agar-agar to make jam. Mm. And they'd been using it for a long time. Basically making this stuff that you've made, Manu. Mm-hmm. They'd been using it for a long time and they needed something to grow bacteria on. And she said, well, why don't we try this? And Robert Koch did try that. And then he managed to isolate the tuberculum bacterium, which caused tuberculosis. And he won the Nobel Prize for that.
Really?
But he didn't mention Fanny in his speech or anything like that.
Boo.
Boo.
Boo. How many times a day do you guys eat seaweed? On an average day?
Well, I had some this morning.
Ooh.
Did you?
Yeah, I had sushi this morning.
There we go.
I had nori.
Actually? Yeah. Nice.
Yeah.
The Wetherspoons breakfast has been changing a lot in recent years.
See?
Absolutely.
I don't knowingly eat it at all. My daughter loves it, but I don't like it at all.
But probably, James, you eat seaweed several times a day.
No, mm-hmm.
Yes.
Never.
This is the crazy thing. Most commercially produced foods rely on phycoloids. Phycoloids. These are commercial extracts that are derived from seaweed. And basically what they're terrific at is thickening and stabilizing and gelling and all the things that you need food to do commercially. And you get liquids and various liquids and pastes. And what is modern commercial food except a mix of liquids and pastes? Solidified.
Yeah, yeah.
So jelly beans, frozen cheesecake, ready-made lasagna. Mm-hmm. James, I'm talking about your breakfast every day.
What about cold burnt toast with low cholesterol spread?
Cold burnt toast is on here.
Surely spread.
Lots of spreads, I'm sure. Canned luncheon meat. James, I know you love luncheon meat. Chocolate milk.
I'm actually on, when I go to a restaurant, I ask them if they have a non-phycoloid menu.
They love you. They absolutely love you.
They say, any allergies, sir? Yes, I don't really eat phycoloids.
It's stunning what it said. Eggnog.
Yeah. I mean, yes.
I listed a few niche ones in there, but a lot of
this
foods.
Is great contraceptive chat right now.
It's fruit yogurt. I've cornered some poor girl in the corner of a party. Fish fingers, coleslaw, for heaven's sake. Have you guys heard of the kelp highway hypothesis?
Excellent. No, I haven't.
Okay, so kelp is a type of seaweed. A highway is, so the kelp is moving somewhere.
It's actually not kelp moving, it's people moving, thanks to kelp.
Oh.
And it's a hypothesis. Okay, it's the theory. We all know the boring old theory about how people got into the New World over the Arctic or land
bridges,
whatever.
Yeah, the Bering Bridge, maybe?
Maybe the Bering Bridge, whatever. Actually, what this theory posits is that there are these massive kelp forests stretching all the way from Alaska down to Southern California, I mean, down the coast of Canada and the USA, basically, and across from Japan. Mm-hmm. The theory is early humans settled the Americas basically by following the kelp.
Cool.
And that's how they had the nutrients to get along that route. You know?
So they're not like walking on the kelp.
They're not walking on the kelp.
Is what I imagine.
They're going, okay. they're eating the kelp. And Northern California used to have these huge pyramids of mollusk shells from where the early settlers had eaten them, feasted, and they were all flattened, sadly. But they used to be there, these massive great pyramids of what they'd left behind.
Very cool. Oh,
that's cool. Very cool.
And this agar that we have on the table, there are a few interesting things about that. So, you know the bubbles in bubble tea? They're usually made of tapioca, but you can make them out of this as well.
Okay.
And so you can get special ones that have this in. And also, the way that you make it is you get this seaweed and then you put it on the beach and then you dry it off and then you freeze it. And then you thaw it again, and then you freeze it, then you thaw it again. But this was discovered accidentally by a Japanese innkeeper in 1658 when he accidentally left it outside on a frosty morning, came back, it was frozen, thought, oh no, I'm going to have to bring that in, and then made the same mistake for day after day after day.
Brilliant.
And kept freezing it, and then found that it had got rid of a lot of the impurities and that they could make proper agar jelly out of it.
His family is saying, can you please bring in that seaweed? He's like, I'm busy, I'll do it. That's a wonderful accidental discovery story.
How will our discoveries happen? By cock-ups.
Yeah, and fanny-ups.
Wow, apologies. Not right, they're out of history.
I was looking into futuristic seaweed. There's a group called the Safe Seaweed Coalition.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Nice.
This is my kind of people.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's a dangerous seaweed coalition. Possibly there is. But basically, they advocate farming more of it. And what they think is that if we just add a bit more seaweed, this will help secure a good chunk of the world's food supply. If we farmed on 0.03% of the ocean surface, you could add 10% to the world's food supply and free up a load of land that's currently used for farming, you know, crops. You can actually provide a lot of this stuff with seaweed. And there are various ideas, like there are seaweed / wind farms, which is lovely, where you've basically strung out lines, grown seaweed on them next to a wind farm. It just grows. It doesn't need land. It doesn't need fresh water. It doesn't need fertilizers.
Okay.
It just grows.
Yeah.
And then you harvest it by attaching it to the wind turbine and like pulling it up like a spaghetti fork.
Like that. It's exactly like that. But basically, I think it's the food of tomorrow. I think
you just gotta. Sometimes you just have to add some whimsy to these ideas, otherwise people are not going to go for them.
I hear you.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks.
like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hey everyone, this week's episode of Fish is sponsored by Babbel.
Yes, now if you don't know Babbel, Babbel is a way for you to learn new languages or to relearn languages you may have learned in the past. And I don't know about you, Dan, if you have ever felt overwhelmed by the idea of learning a language, that is very common. Almost everyone trying to learn a new language gives up. The nice thing about Babbel is that it's very easy to get started. They understand that people learn differently, so you can do a brief lesson, you can dive into a podcast, you can speak out loud to get the practice in. There are all these different routes on Babbel, and they make it super simple to get learning language fast.
That's right. It's almost like you get tricked into learning a language better. I always think that we used to sit in classes and try to learn a language and it wouldn't seep in. But if you ever meet someone who grew up overseas, they largely learned it by watching episodes of Friends or Seinfeld back in the day. That's what Babbel can do for you. It makes it fun. It makes it interesting. It finds your right point of entry to get these words logged in your head. And you must try it out if you're learning a language or wanting to, because this really is the best way. They've got 25 million subscribers worldwide and 14 languages to choose from.
That's right. So however you want to learn a language, Babbel can do it, and why not give it a go? Here is a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now you can get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription at babbel.com/fish. BABBEL.com.
That's right. That is an insane amount off. 60% off. Now do it. Do it. Go to babbel.com/fish and claim that now. Rules and restrictions may apply. Okay, on with the podcast.
On with the show.
Okay, it is time for fact number 2, and that is my fact. My fact this week is that in Disney's Three Little Pigs, the pig who built his house out of bricks was voiced by a man who grew up in a house made of sticks.
Such a good fact.
How did you find this?
I got lost down the rabbit hole highway and I randomly discovered it. So this was a very famous actor in his day, voice actor, as well as a screen actor. He was called Pinto Colvig. Mm. We'll get into him in a bit, but he was the voice not only behind one of the little pigs, but he was the original voice of Goofy. He was two of the seven dwarves in Snow White. He did a lot of big voices for Disney. And I read that he was the pig who made his house of bricks. And I thought, I wonder if he lived in a house made of sticks. And I spent 3 hours Googling. And I eventually found...
It was a remote control fish.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, that's the term we use when you hope a fact is true and you desperately search to try and prove it.
So a house made of sticks. We're not just talking a wooden house here.
We are talking a wooden house.
It's a wooden house.
Yeah. Oh, no, but it's a technical term, isn't it?
Yeah, stick build is a term that you would use for wooden houses.
You say he grew up there, he didn't live there his whole life, did he?
No.
Like, he had to leave when the big bad wolf blew it down.
Yeah, they flee town. So the house is a very specific house. You can still see it on Google Maps. I did that this morning. The address is 410 South Oregon Street, Jacksonville in Oregon. Okay. And I found an original description of it, which was, it's a 1.5 story wood frame house with gable roof that stands on a hillside overlooking much of Jacksonville.
Question. You said it's a 1.5 story building?
Yeah.
What's going on there?
Mezzanine.
Mezzanine. Yeah.
I mean, it must be.
Converted attic, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
When you sent this fact round, my first thought was great fact. Second thought was, I don't really know this Disney Three Little Pigs. Like, I know all the movies of Disney. I thought I did.
Yeah.
But then I watched it on YouTube, and it is a short, but I definitely knew it. Like, I had it growing up. I think we must have had it on cassette or something growing up.
Yeah.
Because it's the one which has the song, Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf?
That song.
Yeah. It's 1933 that it was made. It is a short, but it won the Oscar for Best Short Animation that year. But yeah, he was an amazing character. And other notable things that he did in his career, he voiced one of the Munchkins in The Wizard of Oz. Mm-hmm. He's one of those guys where his footprint is just kind of on all these major classics. But most importantly, for a decade, he played Bozo the Clown.
He was the first Bozo the Clown.
He was the original, was he?
Because Bozo the Clown was a big franchise.
Right. Yeah,
there were Bozos all over the place, and that's why we did a thing about clowns, and I researched Bozos, and I never mentioned it. Basically, there's a spell. In fact, recently there was a rash of obituaries of Bozos.
Yeah,
and you'll see a headline like Bozo the Clown has died. Oh, this is
some other Bozos died.
So basically, it's very much who's this clown? You know, it's just loads and loads of Bozos,
including his son, who was a Bozo as well.
His son, my God.
Yeah, Nepo Clown though.
But I think in 2026, I reckon we'd be more familiar with Goofy than Bozo the Clown in the UK at least. Sure.
Absolutely, very true.
Mm-hmm. I will just say that his son also played Bozo the Clown and therefore will have had big shoes to fill.
Oh,
he will say
very
that.
Nice.
James, can you just edit that in back when we were... when
it's,
it was?
It's not really going to work. I'm going to have to keep the big gaps.
That's okay. he voiced Sleepy and Grumpy well. And he was the original voice of Pluto and Bluto.
Who's Bluto?
Bluto
Who's
is
Bluto.
The meanie and Popeye.
Yeah, Baddie and Popeye.
He took over that role, so he wasn't the original Bluto, but he was the original Goofy, and he fell out with Walt Disney. Mm. And after he fell out with Disney and left, there was a couple of years where there was no Goofy because they just didn't replace him.
Well,
Disney...
he owned Goofy, basically. He owned the voice. And he owned the mannerisms.
Interesting.
Because he invented a character called the Apple Knocker. And the Apple Knocker was based on someone he knew growing up. He called him a grinny, half-baked village nitwit.
Oh.
This Apple Knocker. But he based his voice and his mannerisms and the way that he walked on this person. And then Goofy came along and he used his existing character. Huh. Mm. So it meant that like there were lots of things that you couldn't copy from Disney, but you could copy Goofy because it wasn't really owned by Disney.
I had a really nice story from Pinto's autobiography about making Snow White.
Oh yeah.
He was also a fantastic musician. I think he played the clarinet. And they have a deleted scene about soup. And it's just a really long stint of them singing about soup. But the way they created the noises were actually having soup every day, making all of these slurping, gurgling sounds, but in harmony with each other, like a 7-part harmony for each of the dwarves. And they had a really big argument about what liquid it should be, because no one wanted to eat soup first thing in the morning for like days on end, creating the song. So they were going to use water, but that wasn't like slurpy, gurgly enough. Mm. Then they all decided beer. We'll just do beer. We all love beer. But it was too frothy and it wasn't going to make the slurping noises that they wanted. So they landed on buttermilk. So they spent nearly a week just slurping buttermilk and created this incredible song.
Just one more thing on this Three Little Pigs movie. Mm. It came out in 1933, which was the worst year of the Depression. And basically, Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf became a song that everyone would sing as if to say, you know, we'll get through this. Mm. You know, like Things Can Only Get Better by Dee Ream. It was like, it's like the Bat song of its day.
Nice.
I do like that there are a few behind the scenes things about it. There's the song in it where they have to rhyme the word wolf at the end of one of the lines and they don't manage it. They spent 3 hours with everyone, every creative member of the team sitting around.
Who's afraid of the Persian Gulf? That's what I've been singing now.
Beautiful. Yeah, they couldn't find it in the end, and so they decided, let's just fix it by making the two pigs play a flute and a violin in place of a word.
There was also, a bit later, a children's book which was based on the Three Little Pigs that encouraged children to invest their pocket money in war bonds.
Oh. Wait, I know about this. There was a Second World War Three Little Pigs made in Canada, a special version, which... where Practical Pig is one of the...
I think that was the third pig. Yeah.
He builds his house from Canadian war bonds.
Yeah. So that was the Canadian one, and then the Americans did their own version a little bit later.
People would be so cross today if you suggested children put their pocket money into war bonds. I think that's quite a good idea.
What is a bond? Like, it's not a physical thing, is it?
It's where you give a load of money to the government, and they promise to give you some back with interest, but they use the money for war.
Yeah. You need to raise a lot of money now. For tanks, planes, whatever.
So for the investors, it's kind of a good idea because it's the government who's giving you the money. So in theory, they shouldn't default on the money.
You're not given anything physical back. You could build a house.
No, like a that's little true. Check or a in premium thing. Bonds, you at least get a certificate.
It's fun, the premium bond. I was going to say, it's a little... I'm at the party again. I only really know it as the source of the play Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf by Edward Albee. Which I have read. So
okay, yeah. I mean, the title's based on it, but I think largely speaking, the plot is quite different.
I think it's about sort of unhappy married couples. I don't think it's anything really. I don't think it's any Big Bad Wolf at all. Yeah, it doesn't even feature Virginia Woolf as a character, as far as I remember.
Does it not?
Do they sing the song?
They don't sing anything. It's, I mean, they take all the fun out of it, basically.
That's so funny, because I don't know that one. I just know Me, I'm Afraid of Virginia Woolf by Alan Bennett, which is a play about that play. Okay, but I don't know your play.
Interesting.
Wow.
Oh, you piece it together.
Yeah.
I've got a bit on pigs actually building.
Yes, please.
So pigs build nests. I had no idea.
Interesting.
Yeah. There's a study published in 2002 that followed a group of wild pigs on the coastal plains of South Carolina. And they found that ones who are farrowing, so that some females that are about to give birth, started building nests out of all of this like natural material. But yeah, loads of animals build nests, like loads of mammals build nests, cats, dogs, humans.
Gorillas?
Nests.
Gorillas.
Gorillas, exactly. But in 2013, a group of researchers were studying human nesting, and they found women were more likely to get really into cleaning and organizing in their third trimester of pregnancy.
Yeah, you do hear that, don't
yes.
you? Like people primping the nest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about houses made of sticks, Andy?
Okay, I have a wooden house link to the first ever friend of the podcast.
James Garfield.
James Garfield.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, did he... A lot of those early presidents came from log cabins, didn't they?
Everyone was obsessed with saying they had been born in a log cabin.
Yes.
If you were standing for president, it was almost a requirement of the job that you had to say, well, I was born in a log cabin, of course.
It was the equivalent of a British prime minister saying that they supported a football team.
Yes, exactly.
Like David Cameron saying, oh, I support Aston Villa. Yeah, of course you do, mate.
Yeah, exactly. So Lincoln, there is a Lincoln Memorial log cabin replica inside a national park, which is inside a massive stone temple that was built to Lincoln. They just said, let's have a replica of the log cabin. It's incredibly weird. But basically, you had to do it. Like Rutherford B. Hayes grew up in a great big house, but it had a log extension. So he was able to claim log cabin status.
Really?
James Garfield, I think, was the final president born in a log cabin in 1831.
That's cool.
And I just found a little side fact about him. You know, so he was shot.
Yes.
Ate everything.
Through his anus.
Through his anus. After he was shot, he was taken to the White House, and it was decided that he would do much better if he had a seaside holiday. That he needed to be taken to a seaside location.
Yeah.
300 men worked insanely hard laying a railway track to a little cottage on the coast for him.
Wow.
Isn't that nuts?
Is
really?
This research you did in episode one of No Such Thing as a Fish that you're finally getting to use?
Manu, little secret. I've been trying to get this in every episode since episode one.
Well, I think it's fantastic.
We still get houses made out of wood, buildings made out of wood.
Mm-hmm.
Wooden skyscrapers are known as plyscrapers, and you get those all around the world. Mm-hmm. There's a 20-story one in Sweden. There's a 25-story one in Milwaukee. And in London, they're talking about building one called the Oakwood Tower, which will be 300 meters high.
Ooh.
Will be in Barbican, not Oakwood, which is quite confusing. But they're going to build this big wooden tower, apparently.
That's insane.
How wooden are we talking? Are the lifts made of wood?
So it's the structure. So where you would have steel beams that are holding everything together, you would have wooden beams. And then like the panels, you would have like plywood panels,
yes.
I guess.
That's
and the reason is that actually wood is very good for the environment, weirdly enough, better than concrete. Would you believe that?
Is it?
It's amazing. The energy required to produce a laminated wooden beam is 1/6 of what would be used for a steel beam.
Right. That's good. It's basically you're building a big tree, aren't you?
Mm.
You are.
It's a big tree house.
It is in a way. Yeah.
Do you know about Horace Burgess's big treehouse?
Oh, do I?
Yeah. Well, it was said to be the biggest treehouse of all time.
Who is that?
Horace Burgess. He was a minister. He lived in Crossville, Tennessee.
A minister as in a church minister.
Yeah, church minister.
You're really making us drag this out of me. So he's an American church minister, Horace Burgess. Sorry, just the way you said Horace Burgess made it sound like, you know, Horace Burgess.
Horace Burgess, we all know Horace.
Yeah.
He got a message from God saying, you should build a tree house and I'll make sure you've got all the materials.
We did it. We had a great time with Noah.
Yeah.
So just, and he was doing a boat, but now I want a tree house to go with it.
Yeah, He said, I'll see that you never run out of material. And so he decided to build it. And he did. He built a 30-meter tall treehouse. He built it largely on his own. He had 500 pounds of penny nails. He had a nail gun that he did it by himself. You've seen pictures of it. It's remarkable. People got married in it. And when they weren't getting married in it, he used the space for the marriage as a basketball court. But it burnt down.
It
took 15 minutes to burn down.
Ooh. That's not. I can't tell if he's saying that's a long time or not long.
That's
not
very long. Quick to yeah. burn down.
Yeah.
This would be the best episode of Grand Designs I have ever seen.
Yeah.
It
took him
drama.
Decades, so there'd be a lot of revisits to see how he was getting on. But it was a new owner. The new owner had just bought it and it burnt down, but he didn't have insurance.
Oh.
So he kind of just said no more about it. And
said no more about it.
Yeah, he just, I think he was so depressed about the fact that he'd bought this thing and then he let it burn down.
Do you think God was upset that he'd sold it and that's why God burnt it down?
Seems likely, doesn't
could
it?
Could be. Horace said it was always a pain, the treehouse. You know, he was only doing it because God said to do it. And every marriage that happened in there ended in divorce. So he was sort of happy to be rid of it.
What is this story? Amazing. Wow.
Okay, it is time for fact number 3. And that is James.
Okay, my fact this week is Spain is spinning.
How?
How indeed. Well, it is all down to plate tectonics, continental drift, and a lot of other boring stuff you learned at school. But this is something that's been found out by a researcher at the University of the Basque Country called Asia Mandarieta. And basically, they just put a load of GPS stations all over the country and looked at all the data that came out of it. And when Asia looked at all the data, he found that the European and Asian plates, so the continents are on these plates, they're moving closer to each other all the time. But while they're doing it, the Spanish part of it is very slightly rotating.
Is there going to be a time where Spain is upside down? Is what we all want to
good
know.
Good question. No, it's not spinning in that way. It's not spinning so that the bottom of Spain will be on the top soon. It's more spinning so that Malaga will be in the north.
Oh, that's what I mean. Sorry, the bottom will be. Right. It's spinning like a vinyl.
Like a roundabout.
Like a roundabout. Yeah. So what I'm saying is it will go round.
Oh, yeah.
So it's spinning around the Western Pyrenees, isn't it? So like from the northern part, that's the pivot. And then, Malaga's like slowly going clockwise.
Yeah. Nice. Sorry, I thought you meant that the underground bit. There's not much sun today, is there?
How fast is it spinning?
Very slowly, Dan.
Okay, so my holidays, I'll still end up in the same place.
We're talking geological time scales here.
Yeah.
And even with your planning of holidays, I think it's not going to affect it too much.
This is the thing I don't understand about continental drift plate tectonics.
Yeah.
Because I know that India, the reason we have Himalayas, is that India walloped into Tibet.
Yeah.
Basically, right? Mm-hmm. Like it just slowly moved and then it crunched and then it crunches the land upwards.
Yeah.
If I was in South Tibet.
Yeah.
Would I look at India approaching and like even at the two ends of my life where I think it's a bit closer?
Not really.
I better haul my feet out of the sea, you know, that kind of thing.
The difference is so small that you would never really notice it, unless there's an earthquake. And that's why this work that this guy's doing and why other geologists is so important. Because when you're working out how all these plates are moving, it means you can better predict things like earthquakes and volcanoes and other events
that. Right. Cool.
You know, it's wild. I remember Richard Turner, who has been a guest on No Such Thing as a Fish years ago. I remember him telling me that he half remembers when he was a very young kid at schools, it not being an accepted idea, the idea of continental drifts. The idea of tectonic plates and that's how the planet works.
So Rich, we should say, is as old as Methuselah. No, he isn't that old.
No.
In actual fact, it's true. Like, I would say until the 60s, it wasn't completely agreed.
Yeah. It was this guy who initially came up with the idea in the early 1900s called Alfred Wegener. And he basically was just looking initially at a map and going, oh, it's like a jigsaw. This bit looks like that fits in there. This bit looks like that fits in there. And he was very lucky. He was able to go to both the coasts of two bits where he believed this might be the case. And he found similar geology there, similar rocks. And he thought, hang on a second, this is making more sense. So he and others pushed forward this idea. But he died in 1930, and it wasn't accepted really until the 60s, as James says.
There are a couple of seminal papers in the 60s that led to it being properly accepted. So one was Dan McKenzie's co-authorship of The North Pacific, An Example of Tectonics on a Sphere. Okay, so that was in, I think, 66 or 67. I had a little look. Because I found a comparison point. Widespread acceptance of the theory of plate tectonics is younger than Barack Obama.
Okay.
So I thought I'd look for other people who are older than widespread existence of the theory of plate tectonics.
So are you saying that it started in 1966?
Give or take. It was properly formalised and finalised then.
I think Alan Davis was born in 1966.
What a great point. He's not on my list. Robert Downey Jr., older than plate tectonics being widely accepted.
Oh, yeah.
Chris Rock.
Very good.
Thank you. He's the only appropriate one.
Right.
Slash.
Oh, kind of like the breaking up of the ground after an earthquake.
You're doing really well. Yeah. Uh-huh. Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pitt. Very nice.
Nicolas Cage. Sandra Bullock.
Some of these are less good.
Keanu Reeves.
Now we're going completely off.
Liz Hurley. And again, I was not looking for appropriate people. I was just surprised that Liz Hurley is older than plate tectonics.
Yes.
You know. So what we're doing here is we're listing people who are about 60 but don't look it. So yeah, that's why you went through a lot of Hollywood names, I suppose.
Yeah, like Keanu Reeves and Liz Hurley both look terrific, you know, but they're older than plate tectonics.
They're not older than plate tectonics, of course.
No.
Which has been going since the Earth began, pretty much.
You're right.
So Britain's moving as well.
Oh.
Yeah, and spinning a little bit. We are like over hundreds of million years, we are going to move northeast, but we're going to ride along with Europe. We're kind of forever tethered to Europe, which feels like there's some metaphor there. I'm not really sure what it is. We're basically, and then the Mediterranean Sea is going to close, and there'll be a huge mountain belt like the Himalayas, which is where the Mediterranean now is. So like Ibiza is just going to become like a huge mountain. But we're going to move further northeast, so it's going to get colder. And then eventually it all comes back and we're all one big Gondwana land again.
Really?
That's so exciting. Have they named the next big super
They have, but I can't remember what it is. You know Gondwana land, which is one of these. Do you know who named that?
Is it a friend of the podcast?
No, it's someone you've never heard of.
Oh, let me guess.
Is it a Tennessee minister called...
But it's called? Someone who shares a name with someone you absolutely have heard of.
These are great clues. So, by the way, if you haven't joined our online quiz of Clubfish, James's round is a thriller.
Is it someone I just mentioned? Is it someone like Chris Rock?
No, it's someone very unlike Chris Rock. It's Dr. Seuss.
Oh, okay.
Dr. Edward Seuss, who was an Austrian geologist. He kind of is known as the father of continental drift. And he was the one who kind of noticed that the fossils in Africa and South America were kind of the same, especially if you look at ferns or really, really old plants. And so he came up with the idea that we were once a big continent and he called it Gondwana land.
That's so cool.
But he thought that it wasn't that they came apart and came together. He thought that the water just filled in the gaps and then disappeared again and then filled in the gaps and disappeared again.
Right.
So he got it a little bit wrong, but...
Well, there were so many theories that were going around. There was one that was created by a man called Charles Hapgood, who wrote a book in 1958, so just before continental drift was accepted, called The Earth's Shifting Crust. And that got a lot of exposure because Albert Einstein wrote the foreword to that book. And this was the idea that the cataclysmic shift, the polar ice caps that we get told about all the time, where the poles shift from north to south.
Oh, yeah.
That's the reason that the Earth is the way that it is now, because that spread all the countries out to where they are. And
of magnetism spreads out the actual continents themselves.
Yeah, exactly. So, but it was a pseudoscience idea. At the time, though, it was being accepted as a real thing, to the point where Einstein thought it was a great idea. And this guy, by the way, the reason he came up with this idea is because he was trying to work out how Atlantis could have disappeared in a day and a night.
Here we go.
And he thought, okay, it would have needed a big moment, like the poles shifting.
Well, I will say, in defense of... this nutter that you found out.
And Albert Einstein.
And Albert Einstein. It is important for things like the Earth's magnetic field. And in fact, Earth is the only planet which has plate tectonics.
Yeah, isn't that weird?
And that's bizarre. And it might be that it helped life survive Because what happens is the Earth was a snowball 2.5 billion years ago. I mean, really, really very long ago. Mm-hmm. It wasn't before life, but it was, you know, it was very inhospitable. But plate tectonics create a lot of volcanoes. That throws up a lot of carbon dioxide, which then rainfall scrubs out of the atmosphere.
I see.
And it helps make the Earth temperature stable enough for life. So that there's a theory that plate tectonics are actually one of the things that makes Earth this fantastic.
Is that on Venus? I think on Venus, like, it's so hot when the crust sort of moves, the inside just comes up and then just fills in the gaps.
Yeah.
So there's no drift. It just kind of just fills in the gaps.
That's
immediately.
That's interesting.
So it's a constant solid mass.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's one of the moons of Jupiter. It's Io, which is just volcanoes, volcanoes, volcanoes all the time. And the whole place is just covered in lava so constantly that it's very hard to get anything, you know, built.
Mm. But I think in that, is it not that Disney cartoon where they go to try and mine that moon and they sing, Io, Io.
I didn't see it coming.
Oh, you must have seen that one coming.
No, I walked right into it.
I saw something coming. I didn't know where you were going.
I'll be honest, I didn't know where I was going for a lot of that.
I read the name of every continental plate.
Ooh.
And every minor plate, and only one of them is amusing.
Go on then.
How many are there?
A few dozen.
Okay. Put a lot of time into reading that list.
Is it the China plate? That would be quite funny.
Oh, that is good.
Oh, yes.
God damn, I didn't check for the China plate.
There was only half a dozen of them.
This one is a microplate off South America, and it's called the South Sandwich Plate.
Oh, that's good.
And the Wikipedia says, not to be confused with a culinary sandwich plate. Someone having a little joke there.
Who's got a dedicated sandwich plate? Is my question.
hello.
Let's move on.
Plate tectonics have been proposed as one way of getting rid of nuclear waste.
I read about this.
Yeah, really weird.
Oh.
I just like shove it under the carpet, basically. Well,
basically, so but sort of iconic trenches like the Mariana, they want to put it down there, right to the bottom.
It's one of my top 10 trenches.
And the idea is that over time, the plate tectonics would sort of push it down. Mm. They would cover it and push it down into the mantle of the Earth.
About that. Mm-hmm.
With a gun to your head, James, could you name another three trenches? Because I'm thinking it's the only one I've got.
Yeah. Like, I know there's a really deep one up in the Arctic, but I can't remember what it's called.
Because the Mariana isn't the deepest,
yeah.
is it?
No, it is the deepest, but it's the not deepest. The closest to the centre of the Earth.
Oh, nice.
Because the Earth is like an oblate spheroid, so it's fatter in its middle, like a lot of us. If you go down to the bottom of the Arctic Ocean, the trench is there. I close it to the centre of the Earth.
I'm very impressed that you've named even one more trench. Yeah, yeah. But Dan, you're saying this presumably doesn't work, or
I don't think they've tried it.
I don't like it.
I think they didn't like it either in the end. Yeah.
It feels messy.
It was proposed by a scientist called James/Jim Bard. And he patented the method of waste disposal. So it's like using subduction zones. Those are the kind of areas where it gets sucked and pushed down. And he wrote a really angry letter to the Nuclear Waste Management Organization in Canada after they'd rejected his proposal. And in it, he lists why it's a bad idea. So the fact that it might return to the surface via volcanic eruption.
I feel like that's my main worry about it. Yeah. It's like you shove it under the carpet and then one day it just comes up.
Also, it's really illegal to dump nuclear waste in the sea in a lot of places.
Let's change the law. You know, we're bright.
We're corrupt, we can do what we want.
And also it would take so long that the risk of leakage would be super high.
Yeah. Okay. Let's keep on firing it into space like we normally do. Good idea.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks. Like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Memorial Day Sale and get 30% off paints and stains May 15th through the 28th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Okay, it's time for our final fact of the show, and that is Andy.
My fact is, in the 1970s, the American car industry complained about new rules which said you could no longer include sperm whale brain oil.
Woke gone mad.
This is crazy.
I can imagine Clarkson having a go at that in one of his columns.
Since you can no longer use... Yeah, whale oil was a massive business for a couple of centuries. There is a separate thing. I'm sure we'll talk about both kinds of oil. There's a separate thing in sperm whales' heads, the sperm whale brain oil, also known as spermaceti. And until 1972, which is really quite recent, lots of American car brands included in their transmission sperm whale brain oil. A bit of your car was once in the head of a sperm whale. It's insane.
Do you have a list of celebrities who are older than non-sperm whale cars?
Everyone I've named before. Yep. Everyone I've named before and more besides. That's written that down. I should. Absolutely. Should.
I was literally got my phone out to Google those as you were speaking.
Alan
find
Carr.
Find some people born in 1971.
Okay, let's have a look. This?
Okay, I'll just tell these guys while you have a look.
Okay, movie stars born in the 1971. First thing that came up, as if I've searched this before.
Oh, spooky.
Mark Wahlberg, Ewan McGregor, John Hamm, Regina King. Carla Gugino. I don't know any of these people.
Yeah. Try 1970.
Kei Hui Kwan.
Oh. Okay. Okay. Indiana Jones.
Right.
Well, Jada Pinkett Smith.
Yeah.
Keep that whale oil out of your mouth. Christina Applegate.
You see what I'm saying?
Johnny Knoxville.
Oh. Ooh. When Johnny Knoxville was a little baby, they were still putting whale brain oil in cars. Yeah. I think that's insane.
Yeah.
I think it's insane. And I think this is a very good news story. Like whales, you know, the human species, our species, we decimated whales. We have now changed the laws in all sorts of ways and all sorts of like brave campaigners and, you know, clever lawyers and all this. The laws have been changed. And now, with a very few minor dishonorable exceptions, Japan, Norway, anyway, whatever. No one kills whales anymore.
And let's not forget Iceland.
And Iceland. No, but basically this, and it is a good oil. As in, if you were looking at it purely from an effective transmission point of view, it's the best. It was the best oil to use.
Really?
Well, the car industry complained a lot. They whined massively saying, well, you know what? Your transmissions are going to break down more. And the terrible thing is for the first couple of years, they did. As in, car transmissions became a little bit worse for a couple of years.
I heard they were 8 times more likely to break down.
Yeah, they were.
But I must admit, I didn't know what a car transmission was. Mm-hmm. Until this week. It's the kind of thing that if I take my car to the garage, they go, oh, look, your transmission's gone.
Yeah. When did you last shove a whale in this? Because we're going to have to, there's a shortage of whales as well. We're trying to get, you know, paperwork.
But it's the system that transfers mechanical power from the engine to the wheels.
Yeah. It's an important bit of the car.
It's pretty much all of the car, really, isn't
that's
it?
Arguably their car.
I think potentially an electric car wouldn't need sperm whale brain oil.
Yeah,
because I don't think it operates quite
the
same way.
It needs lubrication, though.
Everything needs lubrication. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, Andy, because you've said there's two types of oil that we'd be getting from whales. So there'd be a general oil, and then there's the specific spermaceti, which is in their front of their head, top half of their head. So 18th and 19th century candles would often use whale oil. Was that the spermaceti, or was that just the...
That's normally just the stuff. If you catch a lot of different whale species, you can render down their blubber. I mean, you literally burn the blubber and turn it into the oil. The sperm whale stuff was very specifically good because of all these properties it has. It helps fight rust. It operates at high temperatures. So there's a reason why they use that in machinery.
Yeah. I read it also for lamps. It was really good because it didn't smoke.
What, sperm whales?
Spermaceti.
As
a lubricant, it maintains its viscosity across a really big range of temperatures.
Right.
Like agar agar.
Ooh.
That's why it was so good as a jelly, because you can heat it up and it won't melt.
Perfect.
Ah,
see.
Cool.
Good noises, guys. Good noises.
But no, it was a really big... I mean, whale oil was just used for so much stuff. In 1935, 84% of all whale oil was used to make margarine.
Mm.
Like a lot of your margarine would be whale.
What years? Mm-hmm.
That was in the 30s. Right. And even in the 60s. You know.
Wait.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. People born
I think Donald Trump is just younger.
1934, am I looking for?
Yeah.
1934. God, that's I'm going to say Alan Bennett was 1934. The author of Me, I'm Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Bridget Bardot, Shirley MacLaine, Maggie Smith. Oh. Albert II of Belgium could have had margarine with whale oil in it.
Wow. No, they didn't stop using it in 34. That's how much was being used, that proportion of it was being
Carl
used.
Carl Sagan.
You see. It was a huge thing.
I read it was used in planes as well. Like, it got all the way up in the sky.
Which bit of planes? That like the
transmission.
Engine.
Transmission.
Yeah. The bits that needed to glide over each other really quickly.
You know what? It got even further than the sky.
Space?
The final frontier.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, indeed. NASA apparently lubed its moon landers.
Spent
whale oil. That feels like a euphemism, doesn't it?
Lubed my moon lander. It's around in some kind of game show, isn't it?
Yeah. But this is according to a book called Unfamiliar Fishes by Sarah Vowell. And she says that they used it until the ban on whaling in 1986.
Right. I read a lot of furious NASA geeks who basically said that it's been used on the Hubble telescope, which it hasn't. They said that it was part of the lubing process for the lens and so on. There's quite a few claims of it being used in space that have been just spread incorrectly.
Okay. First World War, a big user of whale oil. So British soldiers would rub their feet with whale oil.
Mm-hmm.
Because it helped, probably helped with things like trench foot or something like that. Yeah. So a single battalion, which is about 1,000 men, would get through 10 gallons a day of whale oil. And it was used to make nitroglycerin. It was used for soap. Mm-hmm. You would smear your face with whale grease. Basically, if we didn't have whale oil, the First World War might not have happened. So it's the whale's fault, really.
Why do they need to be so oily, whales? Do we know?
Well, I think they use their oil for buoyancy, right? Okay. But the spermaceti ones have oils in the melon, which is in the front of the head. And we don't know exactly what that's for, but I think there's an idea that it might be used to kind of get signals. And
echolocation.
Yeah, echolocation. Uh-huh. I think that's the idea.
They're incredible. They're incredible animals, sperm whales. They're really fantastic.
A really nice thing about hunting avoidance in sperm whales. Mm-hmm. In 2001, there were some newly digitized logbooks from whale hunters in the North Pacific. And they found that over not that long a span of time, the whales had all learned to swim upwind of the boats that were harpooning them, which were wind powered. So the boats would go one way and the whales would go the other way. And the strike rate for harpoonists fell by 58%. Which is so cool.
Wow. Yes. Your face, harpoonist.
Wow.
Eat it, Ishmael.
That's amazing.
Is that the first line of Moby Dick? Eat it, Ishmael.
It's Moby Dick from the Whales perspective. Yeah.
So, Andy.
Yeah.
We have established that you like crockery.
Sure.
You have
sandwich
plate. Yeah. You also like cutlery.
Ooh.
Yeah.
So, what do you think you would do with a mincing knife?
Is it a knife which has a mincing tool on the end? So for mincing meat, so is it like got a grid of sharp metal on the end, and I just shove it into the meat and that minces it?
Not quite. And remember, we're talking about whales.
Okay, I'm still thinking about a mince pie though. But my mince pies contain whale meat.
Do they?
Yeah. Oh, is it for mincing up a whale?
It pretty much is.
Oh, dear.
Not mince as in like, mince just means chopping up smaller, right?
Yeah.
So if you were to get the blubber and you were to put it into the pot, the smaller it is, the more surface area it has, the easier it is to melt down to turn into oil. Yeah. So they would use a mincing knife for that. And they had all sorts of specialized cutlery on these whaling ships. Oh, so God. As well as a mincing knife, they had a cutting spade.
Mm.
They had a head spade.
Oh.
They had a chopper. They had a boarding knife, which you would grab onto your bit of whale because you're doing all this stuff in the water, right? You can't get the whale and put it onto your boat. It's way too big.
Oh, I thought
on the side of the boat.
Back in the day, you're cutting up your whale in the sea.
Yeah, of course. Like, whales are so enormous. Like, you can't get a ship that big until very, very recently.
Yeah.
So you would have your boarding knife where you would kind of skewer a bit of meat and then throw it onto the deck so that they can put it into the pot. Skimmer, which you would
just this endless cutlery drawer on these shelves.
You know what? This is the first time, Andy, that I've listed a load of cutlery on this show, and you've not been excited.
I know.
Do you ever have a dinner party where you've invited too many guests that you've run out of your main cutlery?
You have to improvise. Give them the mincing knife. You won't notice. It's fine.
Excuse me. Is this a grapefruit fork or is it a cutting spade?
That's what I mean about it being a good news story. Like a century ago, this was just completely par for the course, and loads and loads of people just worked in the business of killing whales and chopping them up. Yeah. Have you heard of Waken?
No, I haven't.
Have a punt.
Is it awake bacon?
Is it woke bacon?
That sounds woken. Waken was a corned beef substitute in the 1940s, which was made of whales.
Oh,
that's during the war, they tried to get the British to eat whales, didn't they? And everyone thinks it's utterly disgusting, whales.
Well, I think it was after the war, weirdly, because a lot of the food shortage was the second half of the 40s, when the war was even over, and they sent whalers off to the Antarctic, because there were genuine, like, real food shortage in Britain. Yeah. And so they said, do you want to try Waken? The 1951 report, a new unrationed meat. Unrationed is great. You can buy as much of this as you like. Oh. Waken reached British shops last week. It is corned whale meat with its fishy flavour removed. And apparently it had not been removed sufficiently to make it not taste like whale. And it was not popular.
Whale meat is just not tasty. If you live in the far north and you don't have any other option, then maybe you might eat it. But otherwise, like the whalers, they wouldn't eat it. They would catch a whale and they'd have shit tons of this meat. Like whales are big. You could feed your sailors for months and months and months, but they'd rather not eat it, and they'd just rather eat their biscuits and stuff.
I'll have the green salad. Is that all right?
Would you guys try it?
You brought some in?
If I had, would you?
When I was in Iceland, I did consider having it, but I decided against it at the last minute and ordered the puffin instead.
Oh, wow. Was a puffin good?
Puffin was not good, no.
Oh, wow. He was sounding so noble and
tell if that's a joke. It's not a joke,
it's not a joke, no.
Okay.
It was quite a long time ago, this, when I was in Iceland. But yeah, like, puffin's not nice. It's still fishy and it's quite oily.
Right. Well, there's a brewery in Iceland that still brews with whale meat. I think it's like a faddy product, but in 2025, they released a beer that was brewed with whale testicles.
Okay.
I would try that for sure.
Yeah? Oh, yeah. Nice. Well, they smoked them beforehand with sheep dung. So that was used in the brewing cycle, and it was, it was pasteurized out, but apparently it's got, all this funky, smoky flavor released for a festive season.
I'm sorry. I think there's a horseshoe theory of foods, which is where extreme deprivation would mean you had to eat whale knackers with sheep shit, and then extreme fancy foodiness means you're eating exactly the same thing. Yeah.
I think the people in Iceland are the only people who have seen the advert for Carlsberg, probably the best beer in the world, and gone, yeah, maybe it is.
Okay, that is it. That is all of our facts. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in contact with any of us about the things that we've said over the course of this show, we can all be found online. I'm on @Schreiberland on Instagram. James?
My Instagram is no such thing as James Harkin.
Andy?
@AndrewHunterM.
And Manu, you're online.
Can I plug our Lunchbox Envy podcast socials?
Because
I'm non-existent. You can find Lunchbox Envy Pod at Lunchbox Envy Pod. We are on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok.
Very nice. And that is your pod that you co-host?
Yes, it is.
It's not a pod of whales.
No, it's not a pod of whales. It is a fully fledged podcast. We look at weird and wonderful foods, and we have a fantastic chef and food writer called Rosie McKean, who's on as well. And then myself and Jack Chambers, who is another QA elf.
Yeah, very cool. And it's wherever you get your podcasts. Also, if you would like to write to any of us about the things that have been said and you want to have them come on our show, drop us a line, which is the sort of feedback show that we do. Just send them to podcast@qi.com. Andy goes through all the emails. He cherry picks the best and we discuss them. And we love finding out about all the experiences that you've had as a result of listening to something we've spoken about. about, anything you want to tell us, send us there. Or perhaps you have a great fact. If you've got a fact that you want us to read out on one of our shows, we do a audience fact-based show called Little Fish. Goes out every Monday. Send us your fact there. Again, podcast@qi.com. And hopefully we'll read one of them out on the shows. Otherwise, just come back here next week. We're going to have another episode. Thank you, as ever, to our Fishbusters team. That's Liang Li, Ethan Ruparelia, as well as the other Fishbusters out there. And we'll be back again next week with another episode. We'll see you then. Goodbye.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.